Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Jim and Austin, I was looking back at 1989, and I had forgotten how much had happened in that year. It is just incredible. I went up onto Wikipedia and was going through their list of events, and it's almost overwhelming to see what happened in that year. But it sort of all started off in May with Hungary, right, Jim?
Yep. The waters were coming down gradually through the 80s because border guards were looking the other way. In other words, there was enough affluence in Eastern Europe where people could get those funky little cars like the Trabant in East Germany and they could go on holidays. And Austria, which had been occupied by the Russians after the war for a while, had a special relationship with Hungary, that other part of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. And basically, East Europeans were taking this access from Hungary to Austria as a way to sort of sneak out. You know, the understanding was if you didn't make a big fuss, nobody was going to, make a big deal of it and close borders and what have you. And this was the initial leak in the dike. Much faster than anybody expected, this expanded into a torrent. And the whole thing came down.
Right.
Everyone was surprised.
I was reading that by September, 30,000 East Germans had gone through it.
Yeah.
So.
But it was basically the entire, Eastern Bloc. The Russians had put down the rebellions, in Germany in the Germany and Hungary in the 50s and Czechoslovakia in the 60s. But then they had another scare at the end of the 70s, 1980, in Poland, where they almost went to war. And I think the East Europeans realized that the Russians had lost their nerve. I mean, I knew a lot of older East Europeans, people who'd gotten out. Al Nofi knew General Karai, who was the guy who was the in charge. For years, General Karai taught at Brooklyn College, where Al studied for a long time. Karai was the commander of the Hungarian military in Budapest, the capital, during the uprising in 56. And he knew Andropov, who later became, for a short period of time before he died, in office, premier, the head of the Soviet Union. And they all made the same comment during their discussions. He says, Stalin and all the old Bolsheviks, they killed off anybody with any nerve and any brains. They were really, the East Europeans were appalled at the, basically the stupidity just plain stupidity of the Soviet leadership, once Brezhnev took over. They just wanted to be left alone to enjoy their dotage, as it were. There was no spark, no initiative. Gorbachev was a new generation. Literally. His generation had not been decimated by, the show trials and then the gulags, the death camps and what have you. And he was the first, he was their Kennedy, so to speak.
Right.
And he was a protege of Andropov, who told him, he was one of the older guys, who realized that, things are a big mess and something big has got to be done very fast. And they couldn't do it, but the East Europeans realized it before the Russians did. And that's when they realized that if they made their move, the Russians wouldn't come in again. They just lost it. And they did everything.
Right. Now, Gorbachev was one of the first ones not to have fought in World War II that was one of the leaders, right?
Yeah, the post-war generation, so to speak.
Right.
Kennedy was the first one in the West, the younger generation, to come in. And Gorbachev was the first. And that was only because the older guys hung on for so long. There were no elections. And you had these old guys who were basically the cowards of the Stalin period, the guys who were so innocuous that they didn't even deserve a bullet or a visit, midnight visit from the secret police. And these were the guys running the asylum, guys who should have been inmates.
Now, Austin, what do you think the U.S. was doing that helped fulminate this?
Well, let me make a sales point here for Strategy Page. A column of mine that ran the first week of May actually sketches out a lot of this thing, touches on several of the points that Jim made about the various revolts, public, more overt revolts of East Germany 53, Hungary 56, Czechs with Prague Spring under Alexander Dubček at the end of the 60s, and then the Solidarity Movement with Lech Walesa in Poland in the 80s, in the early 1980s. But there was a silent revolt going on throughout Eastern Europe, also in Russia. And the line that encapsulated it is, they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work. Their economies were just in the tank, or non-existent. With the exception of a few of their weapon systems, and of course they made lots and lots and lots of weapons, but most of their weapon systems were at best adequate, but they had a lot of them. And then, of course, the argument is that communism is nothing but a war economy made permanent. And that people understood that that's where the emphasis was on at least public emphasis is on military weaponry. There you also saw the difference between the party apparatchiks, the so-called nomenklatura in the Soviet Union. The apparatchiks in Eastern Europe, they lived like the bourgeoisie that they claimed to damn and despise in the West. Now, when I said a silent revolt, that's part of what is eating away at the not only the economic fabric of Eastern Europe, but the political fabric as well. And as Jim points out, something was always... There was always an eye open by the Eastern Europeans for that opportunity, where to push the extended Russian occupation and see if there was a way to reconnect with the West, a way to, and the Czechs movement and the Poles movement were at least try to slip some of the clutch of the Russian military and economic clutch, not necessarily rejoining the West per se, though that was certainly an insistent dream. When Gorbachev comes in, and I think Jim's done a good job of sketching him, I will point out Kennedy was a World War II vet, of course, but the
right.
thing is that Kennedy had an energy about him, and so did Gorbachev. Now, I'm going to talk back ultimately to 48, 49, 50 here, and what did the United States do and pursue containment, but let me point out something that the United States did in the early 1980s, and this is the Reagan administration, and this gets... It's a political third rail, a hot topic to talk about this, because there were so many folks, particularly in 1983, I don't know if you remember this, Dan, I've written about it a couple of times, the so-called Euro missile crisis of 1983.
Yeah, I was...
Deploying Pershing 2s and ground-launched cruise missiles in response to a Russian buildup stemming back to the 70s. SS-20 triple warhead, theater ballistic missiles, intermediate range ballistic missiles that they were putting around Eastern Europe. And well, Jim gives a good description of Russian leadership. Kind of stupid. But I'll tell you what, they were brutal as well. I would disagree that they just wanted to be left alone in their dotage. They still had ambitions. You see, the ambition with the move in late 79 into Afghanistan, and also the statement of the Brezhnev Doctrine, which was once socialist, communist, always socialist communist. Sounds a little bit in some ways like extremists like bin Laden, Islamo-fascist extremists, saying once Muslim, always Muslim, which is why they look at Spain as Al-Qaeda made a big deal out of, that still makes a big deal, out of the loss of Al-Andalus. Well, the Brezhnev restatement, the Brezhnev version of that was, you Czechs can't, and Slovaks can't leave, and by darn, we're going to invade you during Prague Spring, which was a nonviolent movement, democratic socialism experiment. But Brezhnev doctrine means you stay the way we want you to stay. So these guys had that component. You make the argument that it's, we just want to maintain the way things are, but then you have to explain Afghanistan. And you also have to look, and the way that the Russians had pursued this huge arms buildup that they began in the 1970s, and the deployment of the SS-20s as a signal example of that huge arm buildup, what are they trying to do? Well, nuclear weapons, as we've got a piece on strategy page today about how nuclear weapons brought peace to Europe. And at the same time, they were also a potent political weapon. And what the Russians were doing with the SS-20s was an attempt to rattle Western Europeans. At the same time, they're also pursuing, through their friends, what do you call them, fifth columnists or unilateral disarmers or the peace movements, as they would call them, their friends, their constant political and information attack on Western democratic governments, and that's in pursuit with, that's the soft approach. The SS-20s represent the hard approach. What they're trying to do was shake Western European confidence that the United States would protect Western Europe with nuclear weapons. And we're going to put so many of these intermediate range missiles in there. And the idea was is that, hey, we knock out Hamburg. Do you really think the United States is going to launch a nuclear exchange if we just blow up Hamburg? And we've got so many missiles there. It was a political end, and part of it was to certainly rattle NATO, conceivably that it was going to break NATO. The United States, and go back to 1978 with this, and the Carter administration's response was Jimmy Carter insisted on what he called dual track. We're going to negotiate, and then we will deploy, instead of just deploy, and then we've got something to trade for the, with the Russians. We'll get rid of our Pershing 2s, and the Russians get rid of their SS-20s. But no, the way the Carter administration wanted to do it was, we're not going to deploy because that could be perceived as aggressive, and we're going to talk. German, the socialist chancellor, Helmut Schmidt, said it was a bad idea. The Russians were never going to do it. But Schmidt knuckled under to the Carter administration. Traveled forward 5 years, and it's totally failed. Dual track has been, you know, a one-way street for the Russians. They've gotten their missiles. And so the Reagan administration says, okay, we're going to come in and we're going to fulfill the hammer part of dual track, which is you all haven't talked yet, and we're going to deploy these missiles. Well, the summer of 83 was one constant demonstration. Reagan was going to start a nuclear war. Here's the American nuclear monster, and it was played out not only in Western Europe, but also here in the United States. It was a huge propaganda offensive. Didn't work, and for the Russians, the Lubbers government in Holland got elected as arguably at the time the most conservative government the Dutch had elected since World War II, because Holland, as well as Italy, and Great Britain, and Western Germany, figured into the deployment. There was going to be a ground-launched cruise missile base in Great Britain, probably one in Sicily as well. That was certainly on the plan. Holland was going to accept some new forces. And then, of course, the Pershing 2 was going to replace the Pershing 1 missile that we already had in Europe. And the Pershing 2 was a very, very accurate missile with a greatly improved warhead. It was one that was, this is where the Russian propaganda complaint actually dovetailed with reality, which is, you know, this is a kind of missile that could actually hit us in our command bunkers because of its targeting capacity. And yes, indeed it was. It had that capability. You guys get rid of your SS-20s and we won't deploy it. They didn't do it. Reagan stood up to them in November of 1983 in the midst of all this hoo-ha, including ABC showing a TV show called, a movie called The Day After, which was supposed to be a nuclear war, and of course it was our own unilateral disarmers in the left here in the United States trying to stop our own deployment. They participated in it. The networks did. At least ABC did with that particular show. Reagan went ahead and deployed them, and guess what? Great Britain, Holland, Italy, and West Germany stood up with it. NATO didn't break. NATO stayed together politically. Within 2 years, and the Russians left the strategic arms reduction talks, within 2 years, the Russians are back, and there's Gorbachev coming back. So there's a component not simply of new blood and all the Russians deciding new blood. They had suffered a political defeat with all the implicit military action potential behind it, nuclear weapons and information warfare and adjustments. And like, they had suffered a huge political defeat when Reagan decided to go ahead and we're going to go through with this deployment. There's the nudge that often gets lost in the analysis of what brings Gorbachev out, and Gorbachev's going to try something, and it just gets back to Jim's point about the things that Gorbachev brought, glasnost and perestroika, restructuring, openness, the glasnost, openness. We're going to talk about some of these problems as if this is going to relieve the extraordinary depth of moral and economic failure in Russia and also throughout Eastern Europe. And when he makes those movements, that we're going to at least talk about it. Boy, are people ready to talk about it, because they've been talking about it among themselves away from the secret police since the end of World War II, and when the Soviet armies just decided we're going to absorb you as Eastern Europe as satellites of our greater Russian empire. What did the United States do? We called it containment. You look at, I wrote about National Security Council Document 68, which the Truman administration really produces, it more or less formalizes what they had been doing for the previous 2 to 3 years, containment in 1950. The way I've described containment, and the Eisenhower administration reinforces it with another subsequent document, 162/1, which comes out in, I think, 1953. The U.S. knew it had to have a military component and a solid one. One that was served as a shield, particularly in Europe. But there were other places we were being tested, and of course in the summer of 1950, you see the Korean War break out. The United States also understood strategically that we had to maintain our own economic vitality, and that the United States actually has something to sell culturally and socially. I mean, maybe your grandparents didn't like Elvis Presley, or your parents didn't like him, or whatever, but Elvis Presley turned on an entire a rock and roll, Chuck Berry, and then later the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Now, they're from Great Britain, but they're an example of Western cultural vitality, and rock and roll is an insidious instrument of revolution. Where you think that what it would do here in the United States, but inside the dictatorships, it was the kids liked it. And the United States pursued knowingly a policy that says we are going to be out there and we're going to show ourselves. And part of showing ourselves, well, East Germans could watch West German TV, and of course they were looking at West Germany, and Volkswagen's not an American product, but the East Germans could compare their Trabants, which Jim mentioned earlier, with the Volkswagens. Guess which ones worked? That's part of the economic as well as social vitality. And we largely stayed at that despite at containment, despite Vietnam, which shook it, despite attempts at the The most severe tests of it, I believe, are, well, of course, there's a Cuban Missile Crisis, and then Afghanistan, also the Carter administration making that terrible decision about dual track, over the objections over the West Germans. But largely, the U.S., I mean, we're not supposed to be able to watch, you know, this is the attention deficit disorder society. You know, the U.S. stayed at a very successful strategy that went on for 50 years. So that's what we did then.
Right. Jim, the other thing that happened in May of 1989 that a lot of people thought was going to cause a revolution in Asia was Tiananmen Square. And it has a different outcome than what starts in Hungary.
Well, China and Russia took different approaches to the same problem, you know, the economic problem. In the 1970s, after Mao died, the Chinese had more people who understood where the world was going, because although they killed millions and millions of people, they didn't kill as many of the smart people. In other words, there were a lot of people in the Chinese communist government who were basically business people. They had parents who had been entrepreneurs who, in some cases, were living outside of China. But, you know, the Chinese communists, especially after the Cultural Revolution, which was Mao's way of dealing with the contradiction of, you know, the communist economy wasn't productive. And he said, well, there's two ways to deal with this. One is to backtrack, which is what Lenin actually did before he died in the early 1920s. The other way is to what I call the Cambodian solution, is to go crazy and go as communist as you possibly can. And that obviously didn't work, and that eventually, you know, destroyed the Communist Party as a communist party. It became a political party out for its own good. And Tiananmen Square was where the Chinese people basically asked for social justice. They said, hey, look, you know, we see what's working, we see what doesn't. And what happened in Tiananmen was the politicians won. Now, Tiananmen Square was an example, and what happened on both sides of Eurasia, both in China and in Russia, were examples of where you can predict where things are going to happen in the long term. And let me reel back a little bit. In the 1980s, I was down on Wall Street, and I was doing, in 1987, I was working on the second edition of my How to Make War book, which is still in print after all these years, outlasted the Soviet Union. But there was a section in there where I wanted to deal with the outcome, you know, the future of the Soviet Union, because I was dealing with the present, you know, of the Soviet armed forces. And I was working for the CIA, consulting, so to speak. They had me down there fairly regularly to talk. And I was on Wall Street, and I had access to mostly unclassified economic data on the Soviet Union. And I was creating economic models, no longer modeling war as I had in the 70s. And I would say, you know, this doesn't make any sense. And I was working with the CIA people whose job was to come up with an analysis of what state the Soviet Union was in militarily. And of course, backing up any military organization is an economy. And I was having this big debate with the people in the CIA about how the numbers did not add up. The Soviet Union was in big trouble. Now, according to the CIA analysis, the Soviet Union was still a huge threat. And I was saying to them more and more, I said, look, guys, it's not. You know, it's the Russians invented this, the Potemkin village, the false front. Many people in the CIA agreed with me, but they said, you know, for political purposes, we can't take this to the White House. We'll get thrown out on our butts. But I put that in the 1988, it was published in 88, the second edition, where I said, basically, the Russia is a house of cards. You know, if anybody who has an old copy there, they can see it, although I suppose pretty soon you'll be able to see it on Google, because they're they're scanning all those old, you know, editions. But there I was, and I wasn't the only one. Most people on Wall Street agreed with me. They said, well, the CIA people, you know, as the CIA people explained to me, they have political reasons for not coming out and saying this. But, you know, on Wall Street, you know, the end of the Cold War was not a surprise, because there are many historians and smart mathematicians working down there, and we can see the future. And at that point, the future for China was bright, because it had already taken off in the early 80s. And the future of the Soviet Union was very, very dark. So, yes, there were momentous times. But, you know, China, for example, I guess we should answer that question. I was maybe bracing, all right, seer of the future, what the hell's going to happen in China? China is going to have to deal with the problem of how much freedom they're going to allow the people, because they're still basically running a police state. And in 1989, they said to the Chinese people, it's going to stay a police state, but it can't. In other words, China still has to have its, you know, 1989 the way the Russians did. China came up with a formula where the communists could stay in power as long as they allowed some economic freedom. But if you know anything about history, you know that when, you know, the monarchy or whatever, whichever emperor is in charge, and they still, and a lot of Chinese in many funny ways, you have to understand Chinese to understand, to appreciate some of the humor, but they basically call the communists, you know, the last emperors. And we all know what happens to emperors.
Right.
And that's the problem in China. And it's still to a certain extent the problem in Russia, because after all the tumult of the 1990s, you have the unelected officials, you know, still in charge. They still have elections in Russia, but they're trying to set it up in such a way that, you know, they can control the electoral process, which some people say is already the case in the United States. But people, if they have a choice, they will make a choice. It won't always be the best choice. But there are always people who basically want to, you know, be president for life, you know, have a monarchy, a police state, what have you. But historically, that does not survive prosperity. Prosperity is the worst thing that can happen to a police state of any kind, because you get more people who have more of a stake, as it were, in how the country is run. They care about, you know, decisions made in the center. And that's what the end of the Cold War was all about. The Russians were not, the Russian, you know, emperors, as it were, czars, were not willing to give up power. And in order to hang on to power, they bankrupted Russia, which is what empires have been doing for thousands of years. Emperors have been doing for thousands of years. It goes back to, that's what happened, that's how Alexander the Great overthrew the Persian Empire. The empire had bankrupted itself trying to stay in power. And that particular historical pattern has repeated itself again and again and again. Some people are saying the United States empire was bankrupting itself, but, you know, we're not actually. Again, I'm still down on Wall Street and I still read the numbers. But what makes 1989 so important is that it's just another wave, as it were. It's another one of those waves hitting the beach, and they keep doing it again and again, and it's going to happen again.
Yeah. Austin, you got any closing words for us?
I think we need to do a couple of more shows on this, because it really is an amazing example of 1989 is demonstrative of a number of things.
Right.
Talk on the strategic consistency in the United States. Jim's looking at it as a lesson in beggaring of imperial beggaring, which is I think that's it is that. I think it's in another way. It's a lesson in aspirations, people's aspirations for freedom. Look, Hungarians and the Czechs and Poles had tasted it. Poor Russians hadn't. The Chinese, Jim's point about the Chinese were connected enough to know what was going on in the rest of the world, and you saw the Chinese students in Tiananmen Square. To call it a young people's movement is not entirely accurate. There was certainly that generational demand that was in play, and yet to track back, what was it, 14 years, Jim, was it just Joe Enlai in 75 or 76, who is actually the you look at what Joey Lai said at one of the party congresses about the need for modernization. Deng Xiaoping.
Yeah, well, he
uses Joe Enlai's statements as the formulation for his process of modernization. And, you know, Deng Xiaoping, he's a curious character. He's the man who put down the rebellion and had 2,000 people killed, and at the same time, he's the emperor's modernizer or temporizer. So,
well, he was the bridge because they had, you know, the people in Tiananmen Square, the kids, as it were, had a lot of adult admirers in the communist,
yeah.
Chinese Communist Party.
I thought it was incomplete to call it that.
But Deng's problem was that the kids on the square had a lot of enemies in the Communist Party,
yep.
And Deng had to do the math and decide, you know, which side he'd come down on. And if he made the wrong decision, you know, you have civil war, a much bigger bloodbath. And that, you know, I think history will be kinder to Deng than they were 20 years ago. People were 20 years ago because he had to make one of those hard decisions, that you get no credit for at the time, but in the fullness of time, people do the math themselves and realize, well, you know, it was a no-win situation. And he probably made the best decision. You know, it's like Harry Truman dropping the A-bomb. What are you going to do? It's bad either way. Somebody's got to say, where do we go, boss?
Right.
And that's always the problem in history.
I suggest we pick this up late August and early September, and then we'll do one Berlin Wall cracking time sometime in November.
Yep.
And so we'll pick it up. There's a lot to talk about here, guys.
Yep. All right. We'll talk to you guys next time.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, Dave.